These are the voices and sounds of history. When the world was young, men depicted the story of their conflicts and triumphs on the walls of caves. Later came the printed word. Now we bring you a chronicle of sound, a sound history of our times. Washington, April 1949, and the voice of Harry S. Truman, President of the United States of America.
In this treaty, we seek to establish freedom from aggression and from the use of force in the North Atlantic community.
In Washington, the foreign ministers of 12 free nations were signing the North Atlantic Pact.
It is a simple document, but if it had have existed in 1914 and in 1939, I believe it would have prevented the acts of aggression which led to two world wars.
If it had existed then. Come back to London. On an evening in January 1934, and to the voice of H.G. Wells, prophet of the atomic age, prophet of things to come.
A sort of spasm of nationalism has contracted men's minds. The answer to Whither Britain amounts practically to this: drifting with the rest of mankind towards catastrophe.
To the helm of that drifting ship came first a Scotsman, Prime Minister Ramsay MacDonald.
Peace is the supreme need of the time.
MacDonald flirted with peace. In 1935, his successor, Stanley Baldwin, pursued her with heavy English platitudes.
We shall persist in our attempts to promote peace and disarmament, and I believe that ultimately we shall succeed.
That same year, Britain's well-loved monarch, George V, celebrated the 25th year of his reign and voiced his people's hopes in the first broadcast ever made from Britain's Parliament.
And I pray that we may continue to pursue the cause of freedom and progress in a spirit of peace, tolerance, and understanding.
But while the leaders of democracy talked peace, the dictators of Germany and Italy prepared for war. In 1935, Benito Mussolini mobilized his misguided nation for a savage assault on Abyssinia.
20 milioni a un cuore solo, una volontà sola, una decisione sola.
Aviation was making new conquests of space and time. Years later, men were to curse and bless the achievements of flyers such as Wiley Post, Amy Johnson, and Amelia Earhart.
My flying was done entirely in the cockpit. That is, I depended on instruments alone to tell me the position of my plane in space.
In 1937, the dirigible Hindenburg crossed the Atlantic in less than 48 hours. As the massive airship loomed over its mooring post at Lakehurst, New Jersey, men's faith in these craft seemed to be vindicated. Then, in a split second, came disaster. Listen now to one of the most dramatic records in the history of sound. American radio commentator Herb Morrison is watching the Hindenburg's arrival.
It's starting to rain again. The rain had slacked up a little bit. The back motors of the ship are just holding it just enough to keep it from bursting into flames.
Get it started. It's rising terrible. Oh my, get out of the way, please. It's burning, bursting into flames, and it's falling on the mooring fast and all the folks between us. This is terrible. This is the one of the worst catastrophes in the world. Oh, it's the place four or five hundred feet into the sky. It's a terrific crash, ladies and gentlemen. The smoke and the flames now, and the frame is crashing to the ground, not quite to the mooring mast. All the humanity and all the passengers screaming around here. I can't even talk to people whose friends are out there. I can't talk, ladies and gentlemen.
December the 11th, 1936, and the culmination of a tremendous human drama.
At long last, I am able to say a few words of my own.
A young bachelor king, Edward VIII, is making his choice between personal happiness and an empire's crown.
But you must believe me when I tell you that I have found it impossible to carry the heavy burden of responsibility and to discharge my duties as king as I would wish to do without the help and support of the woman I love.
And so, for the second time in a year, from the ancient palace of St. James, a new monarch was proclaimed.
George the Sixth, by the grace of God, of Great Britain and Ireland, and the British dominions beyond the seas, King, Defender of the Faith, Emperor of India.
An empire's crisis had passed, but now a graver crisis threatened the civilized world. Abyssinia had followed Manchuria as a hostage to appeasement. The Rhineland and unhappy Spain were new milestones marking the retreat of the divided democracies from the principles of the League Covenant. And now it was Austria's turn to be engulfed by a ruler inflamed by dreams of world power.
Rückt unter den Jubel Österreichs in unser Land ein! Österreichische Soldaten begrüßen deutsche Gaue!
Speaking in his birthplace, Linz, Adolf Hitler declared that he had now fulfilled his divine mission to return Austria to Germany. Blinkered by apathy and bridled by caution, the democracies plodded through the years of crisis while the Berlin-Rome axis was being forged and tempered for war. In 1938, Hitler decided that the oppressed Germans living in Czechoslovakia's Sudeten territory must be liberated and massed his troops on the frontier. While the Czechs stood firm, Neville Chamberlain flew first to Berchtesgaden, then to Gettysburg, then Munich, to seek an accommodation with Hitler. On September the 30th, anxious crowds waited to greet him at Heston Airport.
This morning, I had another talk with the German Chancellor, Herr Hitler. And here is the paper which bears his name upon it as well as mine. We regard the agreement signed last night and the Anglo-German naval agreement as symbolic of the desire of our two peoples never to go to war with one another again.
The next day, Hitler marched, and the Sudetenland trembled under the robot tramp of Nazi jackboots. Chamberlain and Daladier were debating how the map of Europe should be redrawn, Hitler was redrawing it. A year later, on September the 1st, 1939, Poland's western frontier was rubbed out. Now Britain awoke. An ultimatum was sent at once to the ruler of the Reich. Unless he undertook to withdraw from Poland by 11 a.m. on September the 3rd, a state of war would exist between Britain and Germany.
I have to tell you now that no such undertaking has been received, and that consequently this country is at war with Germany.
It was summer and it was Sunday. For a few minutes after Chamberlain had spoken, a great quietness settled on the land. Then children in their schoolrooms, women in their homes. None was to be spared the horror of total war.
I want you to get your knitting out and settle down comfortably at your desks. And then I want to see just how long you can sit there with your gas masks on. And when you're quite quiet, I'm going to read your story.
But for 8 months, all was quiet. It was the phony war. Then suddenly, on May the 10th, 1940, the Nazi High Command released its panzer columns and mobile infantry on neutral Belgium and Holland in a swift thrust towards the undefended frontiers of France. That night, British troops crossed the frontier to meet the Wehrmacht. Weeks later, the dazed and battered remnants of a gallant army had been swept to the sea. And across the Channel in Britain, a nation prayed for deliverance. Then came the epic of Dunkirk. Units of the Home Fleet wrote a new and magnificent chapter in naval history. But the real miracle was provided by that great armada of little ships, pleasure boats, paddle steamers, river craft, to which J.B. Priestley paid a grateful nation's tribute.
Among those paddle steamers that will never return was one that I knew well, for it was the pride of our ferry service to the Isle of Wight, none other than the good ship Gracie Fields. She has paddled and churned away forever. But now, look, this little steamer, like all her brave and battered sisters, is immortal. She'll go sailing proudly down the years in the epic of Dunkirk, and our great-grandchildren, when they learn how we began this war by snatching glory out of defeat and then swept on to victory, may also learn how the little holiday steamers made an excursion to hell and came back glorious.
Now Britain stood alone, but with the knowledge that a great empire and commonwealth was ranged alongside her. And from London, nations upon whom the Nazi tyranny had been clamped heard and were comforted by the voices of their leaders in exile. Beneš of Czechoslovakia.
Lidé československý, Češi a Slováci.
Queen Wilhelmina of the Netherlands.
Den schot bij nacht van de stad, benoemd tot de stad.
King Håkon of Norway.
Norske kvinder og menn. Det med vemodige følelser. Jeg i dag taler til det norske.
King Peter of Yugoslavia.
Zaživi naša mila otačbina Jugoslavia, koja će vaskrsnuti moćnija no što ikad bila.
Sikorski of Poland.
Rodaci, mówię do vas w kulminacyjnym punkcie sukcesów germańskich.
And the voice of General de Gaulle.
J'invite les chefs, les soldats, les marins, les aviateurs.
And in this dark hour, Britain too found a voice. A voice to express her determination to stand firm.
Let us therefore brace ourselves to our duty. So bear ourselves that if the British Empire and its Commonwealth last for 1,000 years, men will still say, this was their finest hour.
It is September 1940, and the fields and gardens of Kent are bathed in golden sunshine. But up there, with the blue autumn sky as their arena, Hurricanes and Spitfires of the RAF gave battle to Goering's vaunted Luftwaffe. Through weeks which held the breathless attention of the whole world, the immortal few fought the Battle of Britain from dawn to dusk. They saved Britain from invasion when she was weak, and by saving her, they saved humanity. But now, under cover of the long winter nights, a new ordeal began. An ordeal by fire, by bombs. If you lived in Britain then, you will remember this sound. Out of the heavens, hell came to London. Lethal cargoes were unloaded and the bombers droned back into the dawn. And always over the ruins and tears left behind, the cheerful, irrepressible Cockney spirit of the Londoner reasserted itself. The story of one such Londoner was recorded by another one, cab driver Harry Anderson. It was early morning and the bombers had gone. And then in the silence of a Brit city, Harry heard a woman singing. He found her surrounded by rubble and broken glass, cleaning her front doorstep.
She was well on the stout side, and she looked as if she'd been the mother of about 8 or 9 kids. She looked a sort who wouldn't leave her house unless she was carried out feet first. You know, as if she'd been born in that district and had all her children there and was determined to stay there, Hitler or no Hitler. And was also quite determined to clean the front door step. Now, I thought to myself, that's the sort of person you can't beat. And then she turned round and she saw me. Now, I thought, I'm going to hear something. I'll bet she's going to tell me whether Hitler's mother and father were married. But what she said was, you ain't seen my bleeding milkman round, have you?
In their darkest hour, the British people sought laughter and good fellowship. The BBC brought it to them through the weekly High Gang programme of two Americans, B.B. Daniels and Ben Lyon.
High Gang!
High Gang!
Welcome once again to your own High Gang show, coming to you as always from the heart of London, starring B.B. Daniels, Vic Oliver, and Ben Lyon. That's me, folks.
And the best loved radio personality of all time, the late Tommy Handler.
Now, if I make this show a success, it'll be a great boost all round.
Great juice all round, sir. Count me out.
Hello, Colonel. How are you?
But to the members of the underground movements in Europe, the BBC brought a personality of another kind, Colonel Britton. Millions on the continent knew his voice.
You wear no uniforms, and your weapons are different from ours. But they're not less deadly. The fact that you wear no uniforms is your strength. The Nazi official and the German soldier don't know you, but they fear you.
And to these millions was given a new symbol of faith in ultimate liberation.
The night is your friend. The V is your sign.
The fall of France, the Battle of Britain, the passing by the United States Congress of the Lend-Lease Act, these were the first three climacterics of the war. The fourth came at 4 a.m. on June the 22nd, 1941, when Hitler invaded the Soviet Union. Now, Britain had a tough fighting ally in Europe. 6 months later, America reeled under the shock of Japanese treachery at Pearl Harbor, then flexed its mighty sinews for total war. Before Congress, Franklin Delano Roosevelt pledged his faith in a victory that he never lived to see.
No matter how long it may take us to overcome this premeditated invasion, the American people in their righteous might will win through to absolute victory.
Now it was global war. Swept from Malaya, Burma, and the Pacific Islands by the first fierce tidal wave of Japanese militarism, the democracies regrouped their land, sea, and air forces, while the great arsenal of America forged and sharpened the weapons of retribution. And on March the 21st, 1942, a new comradeship in arms was declared at Spencer Street Station, Melbourne, by General Douglas MacArthur.
I am glad indeed to be in immediate cooperation with the Australian soldier. I know him well from World War days and admire him greatly.
On the other side of the world, in Britain, war workers on the production front sang with new heart at their benches and lathes. Deep in a Surrey wood one night, the BBC set up its microphone to capture the song of the nightingale. The engineer's vigilance was rewarded, and then a grim new meaning was given to the words of the Greek poet Callimachus. thy nightingales live on, I hear them sing. E'en death spares them, who spares not anything. In the background is the sound of death. Death airborne by 1,000 British bombers droning out to strike at the heart of Hitler's Reich. Listen now to a recording made inside a Lancaster bomber as it weaves over the German capital. Through the intercom, the crew is reporting its battle with a German night fighter.
Where is he, rear gunner? Can you see him? Down! Down! He's chopped down! He's shot down. Did you shoot him down?
Yeah,
he's got him, boy. Right in the middle. Bloody good.
But now, 2,000 miles to the south, Rommel stood with his Africa Corps at the gates of Cairo, and famine threatened the besieged Mediterranean fortress of Malta. Suddenly, a new spirit swept through Britain's Eighth Army. The officers caught it first when they assembled at Army headquarters on August the 13th, 1942, to hear their new commander, General Montgomery.
Here we will stand and fight. There will be no further withdrawal. I have ordered that all plans and instructions dealing with further withdrawal are to be burnt, and at once. The great point to remember is that we are going to finish with this chap, Rommel, once and for all. It'll be quite easy. There's no doubt about it. He is definitely a nuisance. Therefore, we will hit him a crack and finish with him.